Greetings, listeners. I'm Carla Golden, flying solo today while Ethan McCurdy braves the Northeastern roadways. We are Top of the Noggin, a podcast that brings you the latest and most exciting breakthroughs in neuroscience, with an emphasis on new studies, cutting-edge technology, and neuroscience and culture. Today, I'm going to speak to Isabel Lowe, the first author of a paper published in Neuron in September 2021, entitled Dynamic and Reversible Remapping of Network Representations in an Unchanging Environment. In this study, Isabel and her colleagues discovered that neurons in the entorhinal cortex, which had been previously shown to encode space, transition between spatial maps, even as the environment stays the same. Let's go to my interview with Isabel to learn more. So please welcome the first author of the study and our guest for today, Isabel Lowe. She's completing her PhD in the lab of senior author Lisa Giacomo at Stanford University. Welcome, Isabel.
Thank you.
So the first question we like to ask is, how did you get into science?
So when I was in high school, I took an AP biology class, and there was like one tiny part of it where we talked about the kind of molecular underpinnings of the action potential in neurons. And I just remember being completely blown away by the fact that like the movement of ions across a membrane could give rise to something so complicated as like our thoughts and feelings and like interactions with the world. And so that just kind of like hooked me on wanting to learn more about that process and maybe one day be able to like participate in it. I thought I had to be a doctor to study science. And so I started out pre-med, but I had a really amazing advisor when I was in undergrad, Hadley Horch at Bowdoin College. And she kind of like gently guided me into research science and kind of opened my eyes to the fact that, you know, just because you're good at science doesn't mean you have to go to med school. And so I got my first taste of like lab research in her lab, and I was just like completely hooked from there.
That's great. So before we jump into the nitty-gritty of your paper, could you please first give us a little context? So tell us a little bit about what's known about the entorhinal cortex, which is this brain region you ended up focusing on. And how it encodes space, which is something that it seems like has been known for quite a while. And what remapping means.
Yeah, sure. So I study the entorhinal cortex, which kind of partners with its more famous partner brain region, the hippocampus, to support navigation. And what people have discovered through studying these brain regions over the past several decades is that both regions have a bunch of cell types that seem to kind of form the conceptual building blocks of a navigation system. So the entorhinal cortex, which I might slip up and call MEC sometimes, but I'll try to call it by its full name when possible, has cells that encode heading direction, running speed, and our position and orientation relative to environmental landmarks and boundaries. So it seems like these cells can kind of provide basically like a compass, speedometer, and map to help us form our mental map of the world. More recently, people have been pushing on this idea that real world navigation is more dynamic than just forming like a simple map of the world. So often when we're exploring our world, we have like a particular goal in mind or different task demands. So we might navigate to the same restaurant because we're hungry or because we're like meeting a friend there or because we have to work there. And in each of those cases, our navigational system might want to kind of like be providing us with different information, helping us like achieve a different goal. And so it seems like our mental map should update based on changing cues in the environment, but also in response to internal factors like our goals and motivation. So this led people to study flexible coding by these brain regions. And this phenomenon known as remapping is basically the fact that different cells will change their firing rate, their spatial firing preferences, depending on external cues in the environment, but also depending on potentially internal cues. So a recent paper from our lab, I think, showed this really nicely. Kia Hardcastle and Will Butler in our lab found that when an animal was searching for a particular reward versus just randomly exploring an environment, their cells would change their firing rates and their spatial firing locations to kind of overrepresent the reward area. And so that was a really nice demonstration that something like task demands can cause this phenomenon of neural remapping.
Is that sort of the same thing as like having more resolution in that area? Like if it's a more salient space, then they'd want to know, like, you know, inch by inch instead of foot by foot.
Yeah, so I think that's part of our kind of speculative idea for why the brain might be doing this, is if you have more cells kind of being active in that region where the reward is, you might be able to get a finer tuned picture of that part of the world. There was also a similar finding that tuning seemed to get better when animals were running faster. And I think that connects to the same kind of idea. Like if you're moving really quickly through your environment, you might need a more precise idea of like where you are at each time, and you might need to update more rapidly. So some kind of preliminary modeling that we've done looking at the coding in these different circumstances seems to support that idea that this is basically like giving us better resolution when we need it the most.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what first got you interested in the question of remapping, and what were your original goals and hypotheses?
So I think that one of the most exciting things about the brain is how dynamic and adaptive it is. I think kind of a funny thing about neuroscience is that we often take this really dynamic process of like electrical activity in the brain, and then we try and distill it down to like a snapshot that is frozen in time. And that's losing a lot of what is so interesting about neural activity in the first place. And so I think I wanted to learn more about how activity changes and is flexible over time so that it can support the types of complex behaviors that our brain is so good at supporting. And I was particularly inspired by that reward study that I just described and by the running speed. So a lot of Kia Hardcastle's work kind of suggested that neurons in the entorhinal cortex might be pretty flexible. But I think the gaps in our understanding of that process were that mostly we had looked at just one neuron at a time, but it seems like if flexible coding is going to be supporting these really complicated behaviors, it's really going to require coordination on a much larger scale. Like all the neurons have to kind of work together and be flexible together to support these dynamics. And then I think another kind of missing piece was that in previous studies, it had been really hard to disentangle the contributions of changing external cues, like landmarks in the world, versus changing internal factors like our motivations or goals. And so I was kind of hoping to be able to more tightly control the external environment so that I could really isolate these internal factors, and then to use new recording technology to get a much better picture of what the circuit kind of as a whole was doing. And so my original hypothesis was that in doing these recordings, I would find very subtle effects of internal state changes. So maybe things that wouldn't be super obvious until I did like complicated statistical tests on these cells and kind of sifted through my data. But I was hoping to kind of replicate some of Kia's findings, but on a larger scale, and then go from there. But I guess the upshot is that the effect was not subtle at all. I was extremely surprised by how not subtle our result was, which I can get into if you want.
Yeah, that'd be great. So yeah, so I guess we can take a step back for a second and just describe the setup so mm-hmm. that people can understand how you got such an interesting result. So the task that you did to sort of isolate the internal versus external factors, and maybe just a little bit of like what the recordings are, though I don't think we don't have to get too much into the details of that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I guess the way that I tried to kind of get at these missing pieces that I was just mentioning, so first to control the external environment and make it as consistent as possible, I used a virtual reality setup. The nice thing about that was that the animal could basically explore the exact same virtual hallway hundreds of times over the course of just a couple hours. So basically we had the mice playing video games. We literally used this video game designer software to build this little virtual hallway. It projects on computer screens around the mouse. And so as the mouse runs on a running wheel, the virtual environment moves past it on the computer screens, and the mouse feels like it's running through this virtual hallway. And so we have the mice running hundreds of times through the same exact virtual environment. They are head fixed as they run on the ball. And so what that allowed us to do was to acutely implant a recording electrode as the mice ran. And so the kind of second innovation that I leveraged here was the NeuroPixels recording probe, which is this super exciting technological advance. It basically allows us to record simultaneously from hundreds of neurons at a time. And so with this tool in hand, we were able to go from maybe 5 to 10 simultaneous cells to like 200 simultaneous cells, which just opened this huge window into the brain region and let us look at it in a way that we had never been able to look at it before. And so while the mice ran through this virtual world, I just stuck a probe down the entire length of the entorhinal cortex so that I could record from cells from kind of all over the brain region all at once. And it basically felt like we had been looking through this little peephole into the brain previously, and suddenly we like opened the door wide open and could see like the entire picture at once. So that was very exciting.
Yeah, for people who might not have a sense of how many neurons would even be in a brain region anyway, so if you're trying to make some claim about what a brain region does, if you're just getting 10, like what is that? What would
yeah.
be the ceiling? I mean, I understand this would be theoretical, but just get an understanding of the scale.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's on the order of like thousands to millions, right? Like it's so even a couple hundred is still like a tiny proportion, but it just is like an order of magnitude better than we had ever had before. And being able to see cells in many different parts of the brain region at once is also huge. So previously we were kind of restricted to like a very local area. So if we were in like, you know, dorsal MEC layer 5, we'd be just like stuck right there. And with this probe, we could get like all along the dorsal to ventral axis, which also just gave us a window into how cells that are separated from like many hundred microns from each other are behaving kind of at the same time.
Yeah. And what you'll get into later is the idea of having different kinds of cell types or functional cell types, right? We can get sample from all of those.
Yeah.
Thank you
definitely.
For explaining all that. So yeah, so I guess to start, what did you see when you looked at the single neuron level, meaning like one unit of those maybe 200?
Right. So our first step, once we had collected these recordings, was to look at the data. And to do that, we basically just plotted the spiking of each neuron against the position on the track and the trial number. And we could make these plots for every neuron, like side by side. So you just get this really nice picture of like what everybody is doing. And what jumped out at us immediately was that the spatial coding was not stable across these trials. And instead, it seemed like single cells were changing their spatial map very abruptly at given points in the session. And what was even more remarkable was that they would return repeatedly to the same map. So they might have two, three, or four spatial maps, and they would just kind of like cycle through them. And then I think what was most striking to us was that when we plotted all the cells kind of side by side like that, it wasn't just like one or two cells randomly changing their spatial coding. It seemed like basically everybody in the recording was changing their spatial maps at the exact same moment. So that was just like shocking to us, kind of getting back to what I was saying before about my hypotheses for this project. I did not expect to see something that was so clear and obvious and dramatic. And that kind of like derailed all of my plans for this project and took me in a totally unexpected direction, but like a really wonderful direction because it ended up just being so cool. Yeah, so yeah, the cells were changing their spatial maps and they were doing it in a apparently like very synchronized way with each other.
Yeah, that's so wild. Like, we don't usually expect to see something so dramatic without at least some kind of stimulus or like manipulation, perturbation of some sort. So this would mean that if cell A always fires in this one part of this hallway, meaning that's how it's encoding the spatial map, suddenly it moves to maybe like after the doorway or the landmark or whatever it is that it's passing. And that also cell B also switches its location of where it fires. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, and th there was definitely like a mix of the types of changes that we saw. So some cells would change their spatial preference, like you were just describing. They might care about one part of the hallway in map one and then a different part of the hallway in map two. But then there were other cells that would maintain the same spatial preference, but change their firing rate. So maybe they fired a lot more in map one than in map two. And then there were a whole bunch of cells that had kind of like a mix of those two things. So it seemed like although they were all changing together at the same time, they were all remapping together, but the type of remapping that each cell engaged in was pretty heterogeneous across the population.
So speaking of population, or that right that there's these different kinds of cells and there's these heterogeneous effects. What did you find when you looked by cell type? And I think you spoke about this a little bit earlier in the episode, but you can note that the entorhinal cortex has these cells that sometimes will respond to space, like grid cells or direction of the head. There's those kinds of different kinds of responses.
Yeah, so there are these different functional cell types in entorhinal cortex that support kind of different aspects of navigation. So the ones that are easiest to identify in this type of virtual reality linear track environment are border cells, which care a lot about visual landmarks, and grid cells, which seem to kind of combine visual landmark information with self-motion information, so kind of your own feeling of yourself running through the environment. And so these two different cell types are believed to serve different roles in the circuit. They probably have different synaptic inputs. So the border cells are strongly influenced by visual input, whereas the grid cells are kind of influenced by this mix of inputs.
And so when we saw this heterogeneity in coding, we kind of wondered if there was anything special about the cells that changed their spatial coding a lot or changed their firing rate, or whether it was just kind of a mix of everyone doing everything. And so when we divided up the cells by functional cell type, what we found was that these border cells that care about visual landmarks tended to have pretty stable spatial firing patterns across maps and just change their firing rate. And that the grid cells seemed to remap much more than any other spatial cells. So they were much more likely to change their spatial firing preferences, and they also changed their firing rate more than the other cells. And this was pretty exciting to us because it points to possible circuit mechanisms for how this different heterogeneous remapping might be supported. So it seems like depending on the synaptic inputs of a given type of cell, it is going to remap differently. And so I think this just gives us a nice kind of handle on some future experiments that could be done to like dig into this phenomenon further. Probably not by me since I'm wrapping up, but I'm hoping to bring someone else in to follow up on this because I think it's a pretty exciting direction to go in.
Yeah, the best science always and opens up new questions, right? So the next, you looked at the population level. And I think to do that, you use these decoders, right? Could you tell us a little bit about what you found doing that?
Yeah, definitely. So I think a big question that came to mind when we first saw the remapping was entorhinal cortex is supposed to be our map of the world. Is entorhinal cortex still able to serve this function when everybody is remapping so dramatically? It seems like if you're changing your map every 50 trials, you might lose your estimate of where you are in the hallway when the network remaps. So to get at this question, we used a decoder analysis, which basically just takes the activity of the whole population of cells and just asks whether you can use that neural activity to estimate what position the animal is in at any given time. And what we found when we used this decoder analysis was that even if we gave the decoder neural activity from across remapping events and didn't tell it what map the activity was in, the decoder was still able to really accurately estimate the animal's position. And so what this indicated to us is that even though there's a lot of remapping happening in the population, the network is still able to maintain a stable position estimate kind of in spite of these really widespread changes in neural coding. So it seems like there's kind of both flexibility in neural coding in this like neural remapping that we observed, but still reliability in terms of the network can preserve the things that are not changing, which is in this case, the unchanging environmental cues. So that was a really important result because it demonstrated that the entorhinal cortex could still be serving its main function, even in spite of these remapping events.
So I don't want to gloss over this very important part of your paper, which is that you sort of get into these higher dimensional descriptions of what these maps look like in the activity of jumping between maps. But so I think if people want more of the nitty-gritty details, they can look at the paper themselves. But if you could paint like a word picture of how you depicted the neural activity over time and over space, what that looked like, especially when examining the remapping.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I hope I can do this justice, but I encourage you to check out the supplemental videos, especially associated with the paper. I feel like this is one of those things that you have to kind of see to understand fully, but I'll do my best. So basically, when an animal is navigating a circular linear environment like the one in our virtual reality setup, the activity follows kind of a ring shape. So basically, as the animal traverses through the different positions along the circular track, different cells will become active as the animal reaches their preferred location. And when the animal gets back to the beginning, the activity kind of loops back on itself. So you end up with the neural activity following this ring shape in the population-wide activity space. So that's just like the simple version of a population that is coding for a ring-shaped environment. But in this case, we have multiple maps of the same ring-shaped environment. So the neural activity actually forms two rings in the same population activity space. And so we looked at these activity rings to see if they could give us a clue as to how the network was behaving in this way that was both flexible and reliable. So how it could give us both changing context with the remapping, but stable environmental cues, so a stable position estimate. And what we found, which was super interesting, is that the two rings representing the two neural maps of space were really well aligned with each other and just offset in a single dimension. So basically every position around one ring lined up perfectly with its corresponding position on the other ring, just offset in space. And so what this allows the network to do is just really simply like move in a linear way from one ring to the other every time there's a remapping event, while maintaining the same position along the ring. So basically you can have this flexible remapping where the activity switches rings, but reliable position coding where it ends up in the same spot on the second ring. So this was, I think, a really cool element of the paper because it combined kind of my expertise in experimental neuroscience. Like we were able to see these rings because I had been able to record from so many neurons at once in this virtual task. But I was also able to collaborate with some theoretical neuroscientists here at Stanford. So Alex Williams was instrumental in that piece of the paper. And I think without his expertise in these kind of like high dimensional statistics, we would not have been able to do this key analysis. So I think that piece of the paper really illustrates the collaborative nature of this project and the way that it kind of became greater than the sum of its parts. So I'm super grateful to Alex for his help on that part of things.
Yeah, and if I think something that would be cool to learn about is it's a good way to get into this idea of manifolds in neural activity, which opens a lot of doors to other work, other computational work. So I encourage people to check that out if they're interested. So lastly, you related this encoding to behavior, and I know that this is something that you're continuing to look at, you know, relating why maybe they might be switching between maps as they navigate along this hallway. But what at this point have you learned about how the neural activity relates to the behavioral state?
Yeah, so I think that was the final kind of big question in our minds was if we weren't changing the task and we weren't changing the environment at all, why would the neural activity be remapping in this way at all? And so we took a hint from some of the prior work that I was describing at the top of the episode, where people had found that running speed impacted entorhinal coding. And so I looked at how running speed related to the remapping, and we were kind of happy to see that slower running speeds seemed to correlate with remapping events. So Every time the neural activity remapped, the animal tended to be running slower than it had been running when the activity was more stable. So this is another one of the places in the paper where there are more questions than answers, but it's kind of this tantalizing hint that there's a behavioral state component to this neural flexibility that we're seeing. So running speed is a really complicated behavioral factor. I think it can relate to things like motivation or task engagement in this case, because if the animal runs faster, it will find more of these random rewards. But it can also relate to like general arousal state or just be running speed, and it could just be running speed itself impacting things. So I think we're really interested now to look more deeply into whether it's running speed itself that is shaping neural remapping here, or whether it's some other kind of like related factor like motivation or engagement or arousal state. So I have a really amazing rotation student working with me this quarter who's following up on this part of the project. So hopefully we'll have more news there soon.
That's exciting. Well, stay tuned to hear about what you find. So I think the last question about your paper is, what's one thing that you hope your readers will come away with?
Something that I was really excited about in this paper was the population level perspective on neural coding that we talked about. So having this new technology gave us the capacity to look at neural coding in this brain region in a way that it hadn't been previously explored. And in doing so, we were able to uncover this really incredible phenomenon. So I think this speaks to the importance of kind of marrying a maybe more classic single cell analysis approach with a population level perspective to get a more complete understanding of what the brain region is doing. And then I think kind of on like a broader level, we were kind of amazed at the level of dynamic flexibility that we saw in this brain region. I think this, the fact that so many cells could remap so abruptly and in such coordination with each other, just opens up a really interesting perspective on cortical coding more broadly. And so I hope that people will look at this question of dynamic coding in other areas of cortex and as it applies to other types of tasks or contextual switches. I think there's a lot of really rich fodder for kind of like future experiments there.
Yeah, that's really compelling. So our last question for you is that many of our listeners are trainees. So since you are about to complete your PhD, I think that, you know, gained you the right to have expert advice on what it is to be a grad student and what it is to be a scientist. So do you have any advice for the scientist up-and-comers that might be listening?
I think one thing that I've learned in going through my PhD is that science always looks very kind of tidy and complete when it is in paper form. And it never feels that way when you're doing it yourself. Like at so many points in this paper, I felt like I was staring down this like mountain of confusing data and I had no idea what to do with it. And I wasn't sure if anyone else would find it exciting or interesting. And it really wasn't until kind of the final version came together that those doubts were quieted. So I think a big takeaway for me was just kind of like grit and perseverance are really important in making it through a scientific project. And it's not always going to feel like it measures up to other work that's out there, but that's only because you're only seeing that work in its finished, polished form. and you're the only one who gets to see all of the behind the scenes, like messiness of your own science. So talking to other people about their own messiness and kind of trying to keep perspective that like your own work will look that beautiful once it is complete, I think is super important, just for kind of like maintaining motivation as you're like working through this super difficult and rewarding process.
Absolutely. And thank you for sharing your perspective on the struggles that I think we all face of will this ever be a complete story that is interesting to anybody else besides me? Yeah, I mean, that's why I like to ask at the top of what is like, what was your original hypothesis? Because like that can just change over time too, right? I mean, as it should, that you get informed by the data and that can like redirect you to new questions.
Totally.
Yeah. Thank you so much again for sharing your experience and for summarizing your paper for us. Where could listeners find you if they have further questions or just want to follow your work?
Oh my gosh, I'm not on Twitter. I feel bad about that.
That's okay. You have your own right to your privacy and to not have to update everybody.
But I do think that I am a corresponding author on the paper. So my email should be on there. And there's like, this was ended up being a super meaty paper. So there's just a ton of stuff that we didn't dig into here. So I would encourage people just in general to like go check it out.
The data set also public?
Yes, it is. It should be on Mendeley and the code is on GitHub. And I think both those things are linked through the paper. So if anyone wants to play with the data and let me know what they find, you are welcome to it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. This was really fun.